Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick, he is Dan, and for this edition of the podcast, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow. If you hear a crinkling sound in the background, please forgive us. That is, that's Dan cycling through his thesaurus looking for the right words to make another weak take here.
It took you like 11 seconds to just crush me. I don't get it. We haven't podcasted in over a month, and I'm expecting like to like ease back in with like season in review and just right out of the gate just get crushed. I see how this is going to go.
Well, I mean, that's just one of the most legendary message board takes in the history of the Musketeer Report / Musketeer other versions of the site. Previously, but let's get into things here. We'll start with the Wisconsin game because we haven't even talked about that yet. Dan, where do you want to go with this? Where do you want to start from the fan perspective on the Wisconsin game?
So I speak only for myself. I know that there are a lot of other people who were pretty aggravated by the way things went against Wisconsin, and I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong if you feel that way. But for me, first of all, one of the nice thing, I suppose, about losing a basketball game on a last-second shot or two basic last-second shots is that it kind of is like getting sort of like shot in the head versus bleeding out on the street the way it would be like watching the Bengals blow the Steelers game or watching any Reds playoff game from the last 5 years. It all happened very quickly, and then the wound started to heal, so to speak. And so, for me, when I look back at the whole season, the six months, you know, you think about the preseason, non-conference, conference schedule, postseason tournaments, I would rather, like, enjoy a season like this one where Xavier played at just a really high level, and it was a really enjoyable season for the 33 games leading into the NCAA tournament, the 32 games leading into the NCAA tournament, and then have maybe a disappointing result and go out a little bit early. Then, on the other hand, like some of the seasons that we've seen recently, even last year, where X was kind of on the bubble real late in the season and never really got much rhythm going, and then maybe they get a lucky break in the tournament or something, they go a round further. So for me, like the season as a whole was very positive, and although the Wisconsin game was disappointing for a reason I'll get into in a second, I'm pretty happy with the season overall, to be honest. And while that stunk, you know, it can't overshadow what was accomplished over the previous 4 months. And then what I'll say about the Wisconsin is the only reason that it kind of stuck in my craw, and I think, Snow, you kind of charted Xavier's possessions over the last, like, 6 minutes of the game and showed how they kind of got away from the things that got them there. And I think if there was one thing about the Wisconsin game that kind of bugged me walking away was, like, it wasn't like Xavier went down, you know, guns blazing, so to speak. It was like they got away from the things that they were so good at all year. Like when Chris Mack was asked by Mike DeCourcy, who's your go-to guy, he said the open man. And then you look at those last possessions, and it's like guys standing around waiting for Edmund Sumner to take the ball to the basket, guys taking contested shots that they don't hit. You know, it was kind of like a lot of their identity. They went away from the things that were their identity, and it was really their offense that caused them to lose that game. I don't think defensively they were that bad down the stretch. Guy hit a couple miracle shots. So I guess my two takes are, number one, shouldn't take away from the season as a whole, but number two, it was disappointing that X kind of got away from what got them there in those last few minutes against Wisconsin, because if they'd have played the way they had the rest of the season, I think they would have been fine. And, you know, who knows what would have happened. Notre Dame was a beatable team. North Carolina, if they shot the way they did in the final, would have been very difficult to beat. Probably not beatable for Xavier, maybe. But they didn't shoot that way the whole tournament. So you never know.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the last 5 minutes of that game, or the coaches might or might not have watched it, I don't know. But they didn't execute well. And I think there was a little bit of panic by the guys on the court in terms of some of the shots they took, just some of the things they did, decisions that were made. And that's going to happen occasionally. And quite honestly, you got to play through it. Sure, they got a bad call. Whatever. Got to play through it. There's going to be more than one bad call in a basketball game. So they blew an opportunity. There's no two ways around it. There's no question about it. They blew an opportunity. That's a team they were better than. You go back to the Fab Five documentary where Jalen Rose talks about them losing the two championship games. Like, I had no problem losing to Duke. They were better. But we lost that opportunity against North Carolina. We were better than them. And Xavier was better than Wisconsin and lost the game. And that's something that's tough to overlook for a lot of people and probably everybody in that locker room.
Yeah, I would agree. I would. You guys kind of covered everything, I think, from the game. The only point I would reiterate is, Dan, I would agree with you 100% that it was the offense that let the team down, especially during those final 5 minutes, like you guys just brought up, not the defense at all. And, you know, people were upset about, you know, Miles' defense on that first three that Koenig hit. And, like, I don't know what you wanted to happen on that play, really. It was like a 27-foot shot, and Miles contested it, like, as soon as he knew. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like it was a situation where he could just let him go to the rim. So I think he played it fine. And then obviously the last play was, like you said, a miracle shot. So I didn't think the defense was bad at all for the game or those two plays specifically. Dan, really quick, you know, I think the one thing about this season, you mentioned how it was a really enjoyable season. And one of the things I think that you just have to factor in is not just were there a lot of wins in the national rankings, but there were so many moments, whether it be just big wins in terms of beating rivals or just like big moments in games where you have like the Edmund dunk on Octavius Ellis or, you know, the JP shot. There were so many different things to go through. Is there a favorite for you that really sticks out from this year?
I think that the entire Villanova game at home was kind of like it felt like a little bit of the program bumping up a level, or the first time the program really felt like it belonged on that upper tier of the Big East schedule or of the Big East conference. And so I would say that probably the moment that was the best was I'm going to go back to it just because I thought it was, because I think it, especially now when you look back at who was involved, but JP stripping the ball from Chris Jenkins and drawing the fifth foul, you know, late in that game, a huge moment, a huge momentum change in that game. It kept Xavier on top, and really, when you go back, if you go back and watch the second half of that game, it's just amazing how well Xavier was playing at that point, how much confidence they had, and I think that was the high point for this team.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to argue with that. Full disclosure, we were actually going to record this podcast last night. And then I kind of got word of the whole Mackinday London was going to transfer thing, and we couldn't confirm it with the program, unfortunately, so we had to hold off, and I didn't want to publish a podcast right before we got that news. So I was going to say last night that this was the first time in a while that transfer talk didn't come up in postseason meetings. It seemed like every year that was kind of the day where we found out who was wanting to leave the program, and this year, I think to a lot of people's surprise, it didn't come up. You know, the guys that we kind of thought might leave all came into their meeting and said, hey, we're looking forward to next year. So, you know, a week later now or 2 weeks later maybe now, we're here with the Mackinday London situation. It was announced today, Tuesday afternoon, that he is going to transfer. The release from Xavier stated that he wanted to be closer to home. And, you know, I think the thing with Mackinday is it's a situation where the staff was happy to have him back. I don't think it was, you know, this definitely wasn't a situation where they came into the meeting, told him, look, you have no future here, and we'll help you find a place if you'd like to leave. It was more of like, look, you're going to have to work hard. Obviously, you didn't have the role you would have liked this year. We wish you would have done a little better as well. You're going to have to work hard, but we see a lot of upside in the future for you. I don't know what happened in McKinday's mind, but he decided he wanted to move on. Snow, obviously the Torian Thompson thing is something you brought up maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago on the message board, that Xavier was still involved with Torian Thompson, a 2016 forward that they had been recruiting back before they landed Eddie Ekior. What is your whole take on this situation now, where things stand, and what Xavier's options might be to fill these likely two scholarships now when you factor in Jalen Reynolds as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was no chance of Torian coming with Mekinde or Jalen on the roster. Now, I'm not sure how exactly it's going to play out, but I would say it now becomes a feasible reality that Torian Thompson ends up at Xavier. I would still bet against it, but the numbers now work out in such a way where it at least makes some sense. Now, where you get into the issue is you start looking at how Xavier played this year with a 4-out, 1-in style where you have a stretch power forward and you only play kind of one traditional big. Well, on their roster, you have Sean O'Mara, you have Rashid Gaston, you have the two freshmen, Eddie Ekior and Tyreek Jones. Would it make sense to add a fifth one of those? Now, is Torian slightly different than those guys? Sure, but he's still legitimately probably only going to be able to guard a center. And offensively, even though he's got some skill, he's still a center. So do the numbers still work out great? I'm not sure, but I think it makes this situation a possibility.
You don't think he can guard a force now?
No, I don't think he's fluid enough to do it.
Really? Because I would have said that I thought he could have filled in at the four, because he'd be definitely an undersized five. I mean, he's like, what, 6'9", 215 pounds?
Yeah, but I mean, that's why God invented a weight room.
this is true. You were the one who kind of – I followed up on it obviously a little later in one of the longer posts, but you were the one who kind of started the Torian Thompson stuff and got that scoop originally that they were still in there. Is there anything else you can add to incite the level of interest you've heard between the parties or who else is involved there?
You know, I've heard it's been significant. I think UConn getting involved certainly is – I don't want to say a game changer, but they're going to certainly be in the mix. Syracuse remains in the mix, definitely, and they've had, like, everybody leave, so they, you know, they've got more opportunity than they did have. And then Seton Hall, Georgetown, Providence, I mean, those are the main schools. It was funny, you know, I actually found out in, I think, mid-January, someone close to Torian said to me, like, oh, he's either going to Syracuse or Xavier. And I'm like, what? Like, that doesn't make any damn sense. Like, Xavier's – they took guys. So I didn't even think anything of it. And then someone else close to Torian told me, oh, yeah, top four. I forget exactly what he said, but I think he said Syracuse, Xavier, Seton Hall, and Georgetown, in which I said Xavier. And he goes, yeah, they've still been recruiting him, yada, yada. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess it's real. And then you were able to follow up and get it confirmed. So, you know, that's just the situation right now, and it surprises me. But – I think Xavier has a decision. They have to really look at the roster, and I think they're probably doing that as a staff today, yesterday, tomorrow, and deciding, do we really want to go 2 feet in on this situation and try to get him to commit? And they're going to be figuring out what is the best thing.
Yeah, kind of, you know, the whole Mekinde stuff kind of came at a good time for them because they are in a period of 4 days where it's a dead period. They can't be out recruiting. So they are, you know, talking about things, gearing up, obviously, for the evaluation period ahead. But a good time for them, like you said, to sort of take stock and figure out what their plan of attack is. And obviously, they had a decent feel for these things. These were all avenues that they had already talked about and explored and thought about well in advance before this news came down. To me, Mekinde's career at this point kind of like boils down to a spin pass versus USC, where he threw that like no look behind the back while spinning past to O'Mara for the dunk. Dan, what were your thoughts on just Mekinde's brief time here and his him deciding to leave?
Well, I think that anytime you have a guy with his physical gifts, like his size and his wingspan, and then his shooting ability, you can dream on that, right? You can sort of think about what the upside is, what the ceiling is. But you know, he redshirted his first year, obviously, and then this year it didn't really ever get crack the rotation. I know he got some minutes in certain games, you know, maybe when they were playing a lot of 1-3-1 and they wanted to play him up top instead of JP. He got a few minutes here and there. But I think ultimately the biggest issue, and it's something that you had sort of focused in on as a storyline to watch early in the season, was that Kaiser Gates emerged as such a useful player for Xavier, especially in conference play, that McKinday's opportunities were limited. Now, you know, he would have had three more years at Xavier. You just don't know what he would have developed into, but I think you also kind of run into that numbers game that Snow talked about, because, you know, there's just especially when you think about all the talent Xavier's got on the wing coming back, the minutes are going to be at a premium, and a guy that's not really a banger on the glass, I don't know if he's going to get a lot of time at that 4 or 5 spot, given the skill sets of some of the other guys they have. If they want to go two bigs, I don't really see McKinday as being the logical second big. So it was going to be tough for him to break into the rotation. And obviously, if he wants to go back home, and he's from the Nashville area, as I understand, I mean, you think about new coaching staff at Vandy, new coaching staff at Memphis, new coaching staff at Western, if he wants to go down a level, you know, Tennessee, second-year staff. So there's a lot of places that he could look that maybe there'll be opportunities for him. So, yeah, you wish him the best of luck. I don't think it's a huge loss to Xavier, at least from a perspective of 2016-17. And the way this staff has recruited in recent years, I don't really think it's going to be a major issue for Xavier, although he is a guy that had really intriguing upside.
A couple other things just to look at. Obviously, Jalen Reynolds, Trayvon Blewett, both declared for the draft without an agent. Snow, we've been saying basically since before the season, I can't remember how early you started the Trayvon stuff, but I know the Jalen stuff we started before the season, that this was kind of going to be the plan all along for them. And I think we've still stuck to the storyline of we don't think Jalen will be back, but we do expect Trayvon to be back.
Yeah, I don't think there's really been any change on that end. As I've said on the board, there's at least a scenario in which I can imagine Jalen's back. I just don't imagine that scenario is going to play out. There's not really a scenario in which I see Trayvon leaving. He's doing this for the sake of doing it, and everybody was on board with it. His father, his mother, the coaches, you know, Trayvon, everybody that Trayvon talked to said, Trayvon, you might as well declare, do it. And the coaches fully supported him, and the coaches wanted Trayvon to do it.
Okay, so
going into next year, you've got obviously Farr and future Bengals slot receiver Remy Abel graduated. You have Jalen, you know, probably gone, and then obviously London. So there'll be, I guess they have 4 open scholarships, and then coming in, you've got Gooden, Jones, and Ekior was already taking up a scholarship. So they have 2 open scholarships at this point, correct?
Correct.
Assuming Jalen is gone.
Yeah, and so we do assume that.
So so I guess the question is, will Xavier move to fill one or both of those scholarships? I guess that leads most obviously, perhaps most immediately, into the discussion of Max Strus.
Yeah, so Max Strus obviously visited last weekend. I had all that stuff on the board if you want to read about sort of my take on where things stand with that. But I think it's basically at this point Xavier or Butler, probably. His mom is in the Hall of Fame at DePaul as a volleyball player, so there's a good chance they're going to get a visit still. But from what I hear, not likely that he would go there. Although you have to factor him in because they are closer to home for him, and apparently that is a big deal to his parents from what I hear. So I'll be interested to see what happens there. He's really athletic from what I understand. He can shoot it from the outside. He can shoot it off the dribble. He gets to the rim, gets fouled, shoots it well from the free throw line. So I think there's a lot to like there. I think Xavier's kind of settled in on this idea that they're going to play a couple big skilled guys at the 3 and the 4. And, you know, he kind of fits in with that. They like the versatility. They like the skill of what they've been able to do offensively the last year or two here. And I think, they sort of see Strus as fitting in, especially if you have a situation where, like, Trayvon leaves after next year, then he slides sort of right into that spot. Not saying necessarily that he's an all Big East first teamer, but he's definitely a guy the staff feels can play a role and be a nice addition at this point.
Yeah, I would say he's the only realistic offseason addition. As we've discussed ad nauseum, the staff is in no hurry to have 13 guys on scholarship. And if they do, they want several of them sitting out. So I don't think there's outside of him, they get him, great. If not, I don't think they're going to really do too much else unless something different comes available.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. I would say it's like, as the way things are right now, that's the case. But as we know, I mean, there's still another, you know, few weeks where guys may become available and there could be other names. I could definitely see them taking a guy that would be either a fifth year. I don't think there's going to be a good enough fifth year guy that would also want to play the role that he would have to play at Xavier, because there's just not really that many minutes available next year. So I doubt that, but I could see them maybe taking, like you said, Snow, taking another guy that would have to sit out could make sense for them, especially with the possibility that Blewett and Sumner could both be leaving after next year.
So Strus and Thompson are basically the only two guys that maybe they're really involved with at this point that would be coming in the fall.
Yeah, I'd say
as of this moment in time. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got kind of two things then, as we sort of look to next year with the roster in place, and you know, we've seen the rankings, Xavier top 10, Xavier top 5, way too early preseason polls. Realistic expectations kind of leads me to two questions. One, let's start here. Dan, what's the biggest concern for this team coming out of the 2015-16 season, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I would say the one thing is that I think all of those preseason polls, probably they're not as I know that those guys are they follow the sport very closely, but whether or not they realize that Jalen Reynolds leaving is virtually certain, I wonder. So I wonder if that preseason ranking or that too early ranking reflects that reality, because obviously Jalen is a big time talent.
Well, I mean, I would say, like, I think ESPN did one. I know Goodman definitely knows. I know Gary Parrish definitely knows. So I mean, if we're talking about some of the bigger ones, yeah, I would say they are factoring in that. And I think it's, I mean, are you saying you don't think that's legit? Would you not have Xavier as a? I mean, it's ridiculous to do it anyways. I get that, but
I have no idea. I have no frame of reference. I know that generally a lot of the power programs are going to be improved next year from what they were this year. I mean, people are talking about how strong Duke looks on paper for next year. Kentucky's got another ridiculous class. So, I mean, I can give you like sort of an assessment of where I think Xavier will be compared to last year, but I don't know that I can compare them to other teams, because I just have no idea. But I guess if you're asking me what's my concern, I would say it's two things really. One is I'm a little concerned. I know that Rashid Gaston has impressed in practice and he's a physical presence, but he's jumping up a pretty significant level playing in the Big East. He's not as big as James and Jalen in terms of height and reach, so that's a little bit concerning. Will he and Sean be able to fill that same role and give them similar production as they got last year? It's hard for me to believe either of those guys would be as good a rebounder as James, but if they can make up for it in other ways, that'd be good. The other thing is, and this is something you talked about in the context maybe of guys that Xavier might look at as a fifth-year transfer, is you're losing Remy Abel, who against certain teams was just an extraordinarily capable defender and was probably Xavier's best on the ball defender, especially on the wing. And losing him, you're kind of left with guys with you know, potentially your 2 through 4 starters are Miles, Trayvon, and JP, and I guess not in that order, but and none of those guys really known for their defense. So I would say there's a little bit of a concern defensively, and then the big man situation is a little concerning.
Dan just being a bad teammate right there. I ask him for the biggest concern. He takes the two concerns, so Snow doesn't have one left to give. Snow, real on the rankings, what were your thoughts there at the top? I mean, do you think Xavier factors in? You have the best feel out of all of us for how, you know, next year's recruiting class is going to change things.
Yeah, I think I have Xavier. I put one together on, you know, just for my own little personal deal. And I think I have Xavier ninth. And what's funny is I don't think – even though, like, Goodman knows, and I don't even know if Parrish knows that Jalen's not going to be back, I think it's going to be overrated. People are going to overreact to losing Jalen.
I do too.
Like, Jalen's production's not going to be that hard to replace. It just is what it is. I mean, you look at it, his production – his what he could be was a lot greater than the what he was. And that's not a shot at Jalen. That's just played out reality. I mean – man, you know, you see that dunk against Weber State? Well, yeah, but it was worth 2 points. And, you know, like, it just kind of is what it is. So I don't think there – I personally don't have much of a concern down low. The concern is Remy, no question. That was the biggest loss for Xavier this year, was Remy Abel, because Quentin Gooden can do that a little bit, but he's never done it. And he's never really played on the wing in his life. He's always played with the ball. So it's a whole different dynamic for him. And he's going to have to step into that role. But is he ready to step into that role?
Right. That's the big question. He has the body for it. He replaces that, you know, the 6'4", the 200 pounds, the strong athletic guy. But as you said, I mean, when you're being asked to be your entire team offensively, it's difficult to go down there and get after it on defense when you got to stay out of foul trouble and conserve some energy. So it'll be interesting to see where he's at defensively and how big that learning curve is. So that leads me to my second question. Let's go. I mean, you can't do this anymore because, you know, the NCAA doesn't pay players for their likeness and all that stuff, and Ed O'Bannon sued and all that. But let's go back in time to where there was like an NCAA basketball game. So think of it in that sense. You get 10 player rating points. Okay, so if the player's rated 82, you can bump up to a 92 in their overall rating. Think of it from that perspective. With Xavier's roster, you have 10 player rating points to give out. Who is most important to give it to, Dan? Who do you give it to, those 10 rating points?
I would put Sumner. I want him, like, maxed out. Basically, because I think that's where he is the guy. He is the high ceiling guy. I think if he becomes the level of defender that he's capable of being with his reach and his quickness, he could be. I mean, I don't want to compare him to the Providence point guard from this year, but like, if that sort of player would not go amiss. So yeah, I would just max out Sumner and just make him a complete monster.
Snow, who would you give him to? Who do you think is most important?
Kaiser Gates.
How come?
I think he is the most important player next year. Not the best player, not going to be the most productive player, but the most important player because of the versatility that he can provide on both ends of the court and the variety of different ways you can use him. If he can be an effective 38-39% three-point shooter, rebound better, and maintain his defensive ability, he gives Xavier the flexibility to have Trayvon and JP out there at the same time, with Sumner at point guard, with Quentin at point guard, with whoever you want down low. Just, he can provide so many different options because of his ability to guard virtually anybody on the court.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I asked the question that way, because I wanted you to approach it from that standpoint of not who's going to be the most important player next year, but who is it most important that improves and makes that jump, if you can guarantee that someone's going to make a jump. Dan, I think I would agree with you. I think I would say Sumner, because if Sumner improves, what does that mean? It means he's finishing all, you know, those times he's getting to the basket, guys can't guard him. He's finishing more of those shots. He's getting more and ones, which was, I think, one of the bigger issues. And then, as you stated, the most important thing is it means he becomes a better defender, which he was, quite honestly, awful by the end of the year, this year. He just was not good at all defensively. He has some playmaking ability, especially when he's off the ball. When he, like, digs down, he can get a steal or a deflection. He has length and quickness, obviously. But one-on-one guarding the ball, he had some really bad moments, especially as the season wore on. I think he got a little more tired. Maybe the legs were going a little bit on him. Maybe knees were giving him trouble. I'm not sure. But definitely struggled on the defensive end at the end of the year. So I would agree. I think I would give it to him. But you know, it's not a returning guy. I think the other guy that the case could obviously be made for is Rashid Gaston or Sean O'Mara, because that post is a little bit of a question mark. I think it's going to be okay, but if I could guarantee that, like, Sean O'Mara was going to make a big jump or Rashid Gaston was definitely going to make a jump, especially with his offense or something, then I think I would have to think about that seriously as well. The national championship game we didn't talk at all about. Nova beats UNC 77-74 in just an incredible finals, one of the better finals, I think, of all time. That's been talked about a lot. I don't want to overstate the importance of this for the Big East, but what does this mean for the Big East? Other than, is it just, you know, guys will quit talking about how bad the Big East has been in the tournament for a year or two?
Yeah, I mean, overall for the league, I think it means Villanova won the national title. I don't think it means anything for Xavier. I really don't. It may make Gottlieb shut up for 10 minutes, but really, does that matter? The league wasn't struggling to recruit. It wasn't struggling to get bids to the tournament. I don't think it means a whole heck of a lot. I think it just means Villanova won the national title.
I think it's I guess my initial takeaway was that it was finally nice to see all of us that follow or follow the Big East pretty closely have known, like, how special this group for Villanova has been over the last 3 years, this sort of Archidiakono, Hart, Ochefu nucleus, and then some of the guys they brought in, Jenkins, Phil Booth, this year, you know, the emergence of Daryl Reynolds and Bridges and so forth, Jalen Brunson. But I don't know that because they made the two quick exits in the tournament the previous 2 years, I don't think people appreciated how unbelievable these last 3 years have been. I mean, they went 48-6 in regular season Big East play. I believe that's right. I think they were 16-2 each year. They won the Big East tournament once. They got to the final another time. They've done this despite the fact that, with the exception maybe of Creighton the first year with McDermott and then Xavier a little bit toward the end of the season this year, they have been the marquee attraction, and they get everybody's haymaker when they go on the road. And yet they have maintained this level of excellence and consistency. And so for them to succeed on a national level, I think it's justified because they deserve it. They deserve it for what they've accomplished over the last 3 years. So I was happy to see that. I think it does help the Big East. I think it silences some of the doubters very briefly. But for me, it was more about, hey, you know, Villanova has crushed this league over the last 3 years, and they've been completely dominant. And now you're finally seeing them go out and just absolutely – I mean, the beating they put on Oklahoma was just incredible. And they beat Iowa pretty heavily. They took down a bunch of major conference teams on their way to that championship. And then to win it in the way they did, you know, with the kid that grew up the Villanova fan, with the two parents that went to Villanova hitting the – or being the playmaker for the last shot, and Chris Jenkins knocking down a 28-footer with Jay Wright with the greatest – poker face of all time, and Charles Barkley doing his jump for joy. There was a lot to like about that.
No question. I think there's two reasons it slightly matters for Xavier fans. I would agree with Snow that directly it does nothing for Xavier. But I will say, and I wrote about this, that to me it is at least some type of proof. Now, granted, last year isn't necessarily what we're used to in terms of, we've become used to this college basketball game that's dominated by one and done freshmen, elite talents, youngsters, and last year's class just did not have that. With that being said, I think it's still, you can't take away the road that, like, you can't say Nova got lucky or just was, you know, I mean, yes, it was maybe a down year in college basketball, but they had to face the number one overall seed, Kansas. They had to face the best player in college basketball in Buddy Hield. They had to face a North Carolina team that by the end of it, everyone was just slobbering all over their bigs and how no one could match up with them and would be a team.
And North Carolina shot the lights out in that game too, which was completely out of character for them.
Exactly. Something that makes them much more
difficult. They had to overcome additional adversity there too.
Right. And why I think that matters is what Villanova is doing, that roster, those level of guys, that's attainable for Xavier right now. Not, now that they're in the Big East and if they make a Final Four run and if they're regularly considered a X program, they'll be able to get those types of recruits. Right now, they can get the guys that Villanova won with. And they kind of have started to do that with, the 2014 recruiting class especially. And I kind of laid that out in the piece. I mean, it's not apples to apples necessarily, but it's realistic right now for Xavier to do what Villanova's doing. And for Villanova to win a national championship is proof that that way will work. And that, Xavier following this sort of idea of getting versatile guys, playing a little small ball, and recruiting guys that are basically 50 to 100 in the rankings will work, and you can win big time with recruiting like that. The other thing is just I do think it matters to an extent for the Big East brand. It's still new, and it was becoming deafening. I mean, by the time the NCAA tournament rolled around, you can say it doesn't matter that Doug Gottlieb's talking smack about the Big East, but it was every single media write-up and talking head was talking about the Big East Conference not being legitimate, not, how it was going to struggle in the tournament. Had the Big East flopped again? I mean, I think at some point it does start to become a little bit of a concern for recruiting that the Big East just isn't considered of that caliber, quite at that tier. Now I think it's much more of, we've seen articles of the Big Five and the Big East. I think it's a lot more of, it's clear that these are equal. I think we knew that, but Villanova winning national championship makes it so that not even ESPN can really keep that storyline going of the Big East not being that caliber, at the same caliber as the Power Five conferences.
Well, they're definitely not the same caliber as the SEC. That I can say for sure.
Well, I think that all that is just noise. I mean, did Ohio State winning the playoff last year in football really mean that the Big Ten was better than it was in the previous year? I don't know. Maybe it just seemed to me that Ohio State was just really good and got hot at the right time. But you didn't hear quite as much this season. Well, at least until Michigan State tanked in the playoff. But you didn't hear quite as much this season about what a joke the Big Ten was. So maybe it shuts the prognosticators up. But the nice thing about college basketball is that all is just noise. I mean, the selection committee has shown time and time again that the hype related to conference affiliation is kind of just isn't that big of a deal. I don't think it's that important, but certainly from a perspective of wanting to get national respect, wanting to get games on national TV, etc., it's a good thing. Hopefully the TV ratings will reflect that next year, because that's probably the more immediately alarming thing about where FS1 and where the Big East are right now. But all right, Snow, I want to ask you a over-under. What week of the 2016 NFL season will Remy Abel catch his first touchdown pass for the Cincinnati Bengals?
Well, that's a tough one to answer, because I don't know if Remy Abel can catch.
Fact. It's been proved on Instagram.
I mean, we might as well just at least what is the story behind that, and what sort of is the the video was out there of him running routes up at wall to wall in Mason. I mean, is this a serious thing that he's kind of exploring, or is it just a
yes? No, I'm going to talk to him about this and write a little something about it, but I haven't been able to do that yet. But this is legitimate. There are connections. They work out with like NFL players and a lot of the Bengals guys at Ignition and just in general. Some of them come over to campus and everything. So I think it was like his Ignition testing numbers were like kind of like caught their attention, and he was working out with some of the NFL guys, and so they sort of ran the idea by. But there is like, it's not just like, oh, he decided to randomly start doing this. There was someone that told him like, hey, you should do this, and guys with the Bengals or whatever, there's an avenue here of where if he works at it, decides it's a good idea, and people think he's got a shot legitimately, then I think he's going to pursue it and probably get a tryout.
I believe the Bengals, the NFL's got some rule. Like, they have, like, something that's called, like, a local tryout or local something. And I believe he's going to take part in that. I believe that's already been set, where guys who are either go to college at UC or Miami or Dayton or are from Cincinnati, they all work out with the Bengals. I think every team has something like that, and I believe Remy's going to take part in that.
It's definitely a cool opportunity for him. Hopefully something comes of it. I mean, you forget that, you know, when you see a 6'4 guy running up and down the floor on a basketball court, you forget that a guy like that is gigantic. People forget that, Rick. That's pretty tall for the NFL.
Goes both ways.
And the NFL does this stuff. I mean, they went to Butler this year to watch Roosevelt Jones to see if he could play tight end.
He can, for the record. He can do whatever. He can do it. Put him in.
He can't move sideways.
It's not a concern in the NFL.
You got to have some fluid. You got to have some fluidity to you.
North and south. Put him on my roster. Everything else.
If he was on Spieth's bag, he wouldn't have made hit a 7 at 12 the other day. I can tell you that much. He'd have talked him out of it.
I would agree with that. So I know there's still probably some lingering questions about a certain musketeer and repercussions from a certain run-in with the authorities. And
just stop. Let me go.
Okay.
Like, there's no way to become Brian Snow's favorite player unless you do what J.P. McCura did. That is hilarious. That is absolutely hilarious. Now, before everyone gets on their high horse, it's not a big deal. It's just really funny. Now, JP probably hasn't found it as funny at 6 in the morning for the last week and a half while he's pushing a weight around, and the coaching staff having to wake up at 5 in the morning to monitor JP pushing a weight around at 6 in the morning probably doesn't find it as funny, but it's freaking hilarious. And it's really one of the most JP things ever. So that makes it even better. Like, if this was Miles Davis, it wouldn't be nearly as funny. It is JP McCura. It is phenomenal. He is a great American. He mooned a cop. Think about that.
He exposed one buttock. And as you know, if you have two buttocks, you don't have one. So
he definitely is Miles Fox Morrissey's left buttock elite.
I just want to.
Absolutely.
When it happened, the funniest thing for me is that, you know, it happened at RP McMurphy's, which is a bar in Oakley, and which actually was the closest bar to where I lived in when I was in grad school. And I've lived over in these neighborhoods for like 13, the last 15 years, and pretty much everybody that texted me was like, "Oh, mug night at RP McMurphy's. That's no surprise." I think anybody who's lived in the Hyde Park or Oakley area between the ages of like 25 and 40 over the last 10 years probably has some kind of embarrassing story at mug night at RP McMurphy's. So, JP, welcome to a grand East Side tradition.
at least he didn't steal the FC banner off at Nippert after the show the other night. So hopefully he will not have any more trouble. I think you know, there were people asking if he would get suspended or anything like that. I do not expect him to miss a game for this at all.
No, he's waking up at 5 in the morning to push a 45-pound weight around. Let me tell you, that's not fun. Not that I've ever done.
Can I tell an illustrative Mug Night story real fast?
I would love if you did. What's the deal with Mug Night? Is there a special deal here?
Hold on. Wait, no, we first need to address, you said illustrative.
It's illustrative, yeah.
It's the most opulent night of the...
Yeah. No, they sell them... You buy a mug, and then I can't remember if it's free refills or if it's like dollar refills or something like that, but it's like very popular. Like, it's completely packed to the gills on Wednesday nights there. Or at least, well, I mean, I haven't been there in years. I'm old and boring now, but so an acquaintance of mine, this is sometime between like 10 and 15 years ago. And I won't mention his name because of his very important job. But went and was in the men's room at R.P. McMurphy's on a mug night and was intoxicated, I would say, would be fair to say. And he saw one of those giant, like, metal Budweiser signs, like, screwed to the wall in the bathroom. And he kind of thought it looked cool. So this thing was huge. And he spent, like, 15 minutes in the stall unscrewing it out of the wall with his fingernails, jammed the thing down, like, sort of the back of his coat and, like, the top of his pants in the back, and just strolled right out of the bar, and then I guess walked home, and then told me a couple days later that he woke up the next morning with a giant metal Budweiser sign in his bed with no idea how it got there. So that is that's an example of how Mug Knight treated an upstanding young professional in the greater Cincinnati area.
Miles Fox Morrissey only wishes he could be so lucky as to have woken up in bed with a giant metal sign instead of woken up in the slammer with two hobos who were asking him over and over about Bronson Koenig. So,
by the way, Jay, if you notice this year, JP, he would lose his breath quickly. He would always look like he was about to pass out from media timeout to media timeout. I would say JP's conditioning will be better going into next season.
I'd say that is the silver lining in all of this for certain. If you are a Xavier fan, there is a positive, and it is that he will have a huge head start on the conditioning program here this offseason. Let me ask you real quick about my favorite.
Hold on, Rick. What? Rick, let's address something, one more thing real quick about this, because as you can tell, this is my favorite topic ever. If there was one phone call you could hear, how much would you want to hear the Paul McCurra Chris Mack conversation that morning?
Oh, I think I'd rather hear the JP Jonathan Paul McCurra conversation with Paul McCurra the next day after he finally got out of court and was released on bail. I would have liked to hear that conversation for sure. That would I don't think that went well for anyone.
I would guess it was probably pretty one-sided.
Yeah, I think JP willingly took that L.
I think I would have rather heard the conversation between Snow and his mom after Snow concussed himself headbutting Sage Rosenfeld or Gus Frerotting the wall in Columbus.
I don't think it was real comprehensible.
It probably sounded exactly like that sound you just made when you first started talking right there. Let's go to our favorite story of last year's basketball season, which has fired back up a week or two ago, which is Louisville announced that they are imposing more sanctions, which is a loss of two scholarships, official visits, and my favorite, Rick Pitino isn't going to recruit this spring. I mean, Snow, NCAA should stop letting programs do this. I don't think programs should be allowed to try to dictate what their punishment is ahead of time and let that lessen the load. Like, look, if you're getting the death penalty, I don't think you can, like, start trying to take it ahead of time. I think you should get the death penalty when they decide you get it. So, first of all, I don't think you should be allowed to do this. But second of all, this is nothing other than Rick Pitino not wanting to go out and travel on the recruiting trail this year, right?
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Rick Pitino didn't go out last April either. He spent a lot of time at the horse track, a lot of time in Miami. Basically, he was just chilling.
And then the first event he walked into of the summer, everyone made fun of him for it. Like, every single coach as he walked down the row. Like, oh, nice of you to join us. It was fantastic.
Now, his assistants did go out, and I guess they can't do that this year now. But still, not really that big a deal. Two scholarships. Yeah, we're not going to fill them anyway. Might as well take our L now. And, you know, the punishments are what they are. I mean, he got the one-year postseason ban. You know, what else can really happen? I don't think there's much precedent for hookers. What's the hooker penalty in the NCAA rulebook? I don't think we know.
Right, but the schools don't get to decide that. This is stupid. I hate that the schools, like, because we have this whole controversy this year about them taking away those guys postseason in the middle of the year, and they had nothing to do with it all. And I think there's an easy way to solve that. You don't let the schools self-sanction themselves. Or you do. Like, fine, you can punish yourselves if you want to do that, but we're not taking – we're not taking any of that into consideration when we also punish you. Like, that's just your own reflection session that you're doing for no reason.
See, this is just you guys. You see, this is just a level of naivete on you two's part, frankly, because both of you are single guys. Every married guy knows this scheme. This is like one of those things you learn very, very shortly. When you do something wrong, you admit to something slightly less wrong in the hopes that the greater wrong is never discovered. This is a classic strategy. And let's face it, all these college sports guys, they're married guys. So they all respect the game. So this is the way you do things at the highest level.
Dan, do you need a reflection session? Like, well,
what have you been doing, Dan?
That your wife doesn't know?
I think my entire life is a reflection session at this point.
New York disagrees with you for the record. Val Ackerman co-authored an editorial with Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott explaining how athletes are getting a great deal currently with their scholarship and health insurance. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts about this. I thought it was a bad look for the Big East.
Can we also note that Val Ackerman did also comment and talk about how student athletes, and I use that word, I can't believe I just used that word, but that NCAA basketball players ought to be able to, didn't she say something today about how they ought to be able to negotiate image rights, or they ought to have a cut of image rights, which I think is endorsement deals or something like that, would be a positive move. And I think that mitigates kind of the stupidity of the editorial about the scholarship thing.
Agreed. So that was. Go ahead.
Here's what I'll say is, does anyone think Sean O'Mara got the bad end of the deal this year?
No.
No.
Does anyone think Remy Abel got the bad end of the deal this year?
No, it's just the top end guys, right? I mean
that. So in that respect, about 90% of Division I basketball players, now football, the numbers change a little bit, but about 90% of Division I basketball players are getting the better end of the deal.
But here's the point.
But the 10% that aren't are getting screwed royally.
Yeah, and I don't think any argument that isn't, you know, somehow making that distinction, I think any argument that doesn't make that distinction is ridiculous. My thing, Snow, wouldn't be so much that what she's saying is wrong. It would just be that when you're the Big East, when you're this fledgling program that is battling this image of, you know, you want to make sure you are a Power 5 conference. You have agreed that if the Power 5 conference go to player stipends, you're doing these types of things. You've made the right decisions. Don't put your name on something like this that makes you look like a small-time conference. Like, everything you put out in public right now, in terms of controlling the message, should be a big-time message. We are a big-time conference, and I don't think this sends that message. That being said, what she mentioned about the sponsorship deals, it's basically the Olympic model, right? Like, if you are an elite guy, you could go sign an autograph session and make a bunch of money doing that. Or you could, you know, sell some cars locally if you're a guy who goes to UK, and Lord knows you can make all types of money. I would personally love to see them do that. And I think it would be awesome to see, like, everyone talks about the competitive balance and how things would shift there. Well, first of all, it's already, like, I mean, the Blue Bloods already run the game, so either they'll get slightly stronger because of this, or you'll have some other areas that are really strong college communities come up with some really creative promotional ideas and find ways to get kids money at their school, and they'll have an influx in talent, and it'll help some other the other places that maybe aren't doing so well. I'd love to see them do this for that reason.
Here's one thing I'm going to point out, though. I don't live in Cincinnati anymore, but I still live in Cincinnati. You guys both live in Cincinnati. How many Cincinnati Bengals, far and away the most popular team in the city, have endorsement deals that you know about of any kind?
Well, they have signings like all the time, right, at Cardboard Heroes or whatever. Like, if you were a college player and you could go over to Cardboard Heroes and make $1,000 to do a signing, or $500 even to do a signing, that'd be great. Like, you'd be why shouldn't you be allowed to do something like that small?
Like, people have this thing like, oh, college is doing an endorsement deal. Outside of about UK, I'm here to tell you, like, a Duke player, you're not going to be selling things in Raleigh, North Carolina. You're just not.
Right. And that's the great part of this. It really won't change as much as people think. Like, people talk so much about the competitive balance. And I'm like, no. I mean, like, UK players would be able to make money legitimately. But guess what? They get every five-star kid they want already. So really, how much is that changing things?
Wouldn't the money really come, though, from guys from, like, Nike and UA and other, like, apparel-type companies or sports companies trying to sign these guys up at a younger age than they currently can? I mean, isn't that where this would happen? I know that kind of happens anyway under the radar through the AAU programs and so forth, but it seems to me that's probably where the money would come in, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, but that leads me to another question that I want to ask now. Why are shoe companies allowed to give gear and all that stuff to AAU teams, and that's considered fine? Like, why is that all right? Why is AAU okay that those teams can be sponsored and kids receive all this free stuff from Nike and those aren't considered impermissible benefits?
I'm not an expert on the rules per se, but it comes down to, like, teams are viewed differently than individuals, I believe, because the last thing on earth the NCAA wants to do is tell DeMatha Catholic that Nike can't support them anymore.
Right.
To tell Sycamore High School that they can't get money from Coca-Cola, to tell, you know, Moeller High School that it can't be burned down. Oh, wait a minute. We need to do that. Just burn down Moeller.
No, Moeller needs that Coca-Cola money so they can afford a shot clocks. No.
Yeah. I mean, so you start getting into, are you limiting what people can give high schools and high school teams and if you start making that distinction, you're walking a really fine line.
And let me be clear. I love that they're allowed to do that. Like, I think it's great. But what I'm surprised by, if that's the reason that they can just give it to the teams because it's a team or an organization and you can just do that, then I'm surprised, like, why hasn't Verizon sponsored AAU teams? Like, why hasn't they provided – because texting and recruiting, it's like the biggest deal in the world. And look at when players get to the NBA. All of them – like, all of the TV of the phone companies use NBA players.
Yeah, but what would Verizon get out of sponsoring the Queen City Prophets?
The same exact thing that Nike gets out of sponsoring them.
The shoe companies – they are convinced this works for them, and they're convinced it's worth it. But part of the deal is the reason why is because they say they see kids, you know, the popular kids at the school wearing Nike gear, wearing Under Armour gear, and that influences other people to buy Nike gear at the school or Under Armour gear.
Okay, so why do you think, like,
kids don't buy their own cell phones, Rick.
Okay, so no, but they don't buy their own shoes either. The parents buy them for them. Like, it's the same deal. You just want the cool kids to have your stuff. That's how marketing works. That's why I'm just surprised. Like, we haven't seen more companies make this connection.
Shoe plan?
When you go down to Atlanta, everybody's in Russell Athletic.
I mean, it doesn't matter. It was just I'm surprised we haven't seen more creative sponsorships as it relates to AAU teams. Like I think, and then phone companies are the ones I always think of just because of the recruiting thing. For one, I don't think kids and their parents should have to pay for phone bills as it relates to recruiting, because it's quite absurd, to be honest. Like, that college coaches are just ringing them off the hook nonstop, and then they're just paying for that phone bill.
They're not ringing them up nonstop, though. I mean,
that's not true.
Like, no, if you're trying to date a hot chick, and you call her all the time, is she going to, like, she's going to think you're a creep?
Hate to tell you this, a lot of college coaches are creeps, not dating hot chicks. They have
Ladies
not learned
and gentlemen,
this way.
Welcome to our new sister podcast, Rick and Brian Explain Dating.
I think we already went down that route when we talked about the PBRs at Applebee's and Allie LaForce. We don't need to go back down that. I think that does it for this edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, which has gone completely off the rails. For the legend, Brian Snow and Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.